Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. But today's episode is very different from our regular show. Recently, I got very lucky to be on a fantastic podcast, Sake Revolution, and I had a fun conversation with the wonderful hosts Tim Sullivan and John Puma. So I'm replaying it today on Japanese. The Sake Revolution podcast started in January 2020, and each episode is so informative and so much fun that I've never missed any episode of the show. So hope you enjoyed, and also I suggest that you listen to more episodes on the Sake Revolution, which is available on Apple, Google, and Spotify apps, in addition to their website, sakerevolution.com. So hope you enjoy. Thank you for listening.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sake Revolution. This is America's first sake podcast. I'm your host, John Puma from the Sake Notes, the admin over at the Internet Sake Discord, and the guy on the show who is definitely not a sake samurai.
And I am your host, Timothy Sullivan. I am a sake samurai. I am also a sake educator, as well as the founder of the Urban Sake website. And every week, John and I will be tasting and chatting about all things sake and doing our best to make it fun and easy to understand.
Yes. That's right, Tim. That's what we do every single week.
Yeah. So, John, I had a question for you. Have you ever been by yourself? Have you ever been a guest on someone else's podcast before?
I was a guest on a podcast with you once, but that was that's a different thing. Not by myself now.
Yeah. Well, I have to say I had the good fortune to be on a really fabulous podcast as a guest, not once, but twice. And I'm talking about Japan Eats. Have you ever heard of it?
So wait, before I go into that, is this a flex, right?
Yes, this is a total flex.
Okay. yes, I am familiar. And I've actually heard at least one of the episodes that you were on.
Excellent. Well, I am excited to tell you, John, that we have none other than Akiko Katayama with us today. She is the host of the Japan Eats podcast. And let me give a little introduction to Akiko. She's a food writer and a Forbes columnist based in New York City. And since May 2015, she's been the host of the very well-known Japan Eats podcast. It's also a weekly radio show on the Heritage Radio Network. And there she introduces Japanese food, sake, and culture to an audience all around the world. She's also the director of the nonprofit, the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in the U.S. And she's worked as a culinary advisor to the Japanese government. She's consulted for companies in the food and beverage industry. And she has also been on TV. She served as a judge on the Iron Chef on the Food Network. And she's also been on Netflix original The Final Table. And of course, she's also the author of A Complete Guide to Japanese Cuisine, which is a fabulous book for getting a great introduction to Japanese cuisine. So we are so excited to have Akiko with us today. Akiko, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. What a fabulous introduction. Is it about me?
Yes.
Tim, that was wonderful. That was stunning. I'm kind of stuck on the Iron Chef bit, but
I know.
But still.
What was it like to be on TV? Was that nerve-wracking for you?
No, I think it's that, you know, the whole lighting and everything, you just decide that you are there and you enjoy the moment. So, yeah, it's just that you are in a dreamland, so you don't get nervous.
Akiko-san, I have to ask you, this is a question that you always ask on your podcast, but where are you from and what did you eat growing up?
That was my favorite question. So
I had to throw it back at you. I'm sorry.
So I'm from Tokyo, and I grew up in a suburb of Tokyo. And then actually, I looked up where I grew up was like now on Google Map. I cannot recognize anything, but I grew up in a kind of suburb and nice, very natural environment. I could take a walk to the river. I would fish with my dad, and the kind of like really Tokyo-like Tokyo life until I grew up. And so the funny thing is, I didn't like Japanese food when I grew up. At all.
At all?
At all.
None of it?
None. So I was like a black sheep. Everybody else, my brother, my parents, they all only ate Japanese food or Japanese-style Western food. But I was always looking for something non-Japanese. So that's crazy, right? What I'm doing.
What was your favorite food? What was your favorite non-Japanese food that you liked to eat as a kid?
And also, I didn't like eating when I grew up. So
this is a broader situation, not just about Japanese food, but just food in general.
Right. So I was so picky, and I was always eating ice cream, chocolate, and something like.
Sounds good to me.
I know. But yeah, it's not like a proper food that I was eating.
And you turned out to be a culinary expert. We got to dig deeper into this for sure.
Yeah, you can do another episode for that. I had a long journey.
So then at some point you decide you liked food and you started your own Japanese cuisine radio show and podcast, as Tim mentioned, back in 2015, Japan Eats. How did that all get started?
So I've been working already as a writer, and you know, Japanese cuisine has been becoming increasingly popular, I think, over the last decades. And just because I'm Japanese, people started to ask me a lot of questions about Japanese food, and then I found a huge demand for proper and accurate information about Japanese food. And then I casually spoke to one of my friends at the Heritage Radio Network, and it happened to be that they're looking for a native Japanese person who can do a show. So here they are. That was the beginning of the show 6 years ago now.
Wow. Did you have any experience being on the radio or doing podcasting, or was it all new to you when you started in 2015?
No, nothing. And I, you know, English is not my first language, so it's crazy. I was just like half joking, and I never imagined that's going to happen.
Wow. Well, you have such a wide variety of guests. You know, you have people who do tea ceremony and fish importing and sake people and all different types of guests. How do you find such a wide variety of guests, all related to Japanese culture and cuisine?
So it's very random and intuitive, and also driven by the fear due to a scarcity of potential guests. So whenever I find somebody interesting that really intrigues me, I just contact the person and a book right away. I could find interesting people in the media, or it can be suggested by show guests, the show listeners. The first time I started the show, I thought my expectation was that I could just do a show for only a week, a year, because I thought I would run out guests who knows Japanese cuisine and can speak English. But surprise, surprise, I was able to find a lot of people, great Japanese-related people like Tim, for example. So I have a long list now, but I am really blessed to be able to find so many amazing people who are interested in Japanese cuisine.
So you mentioned that you cover, you know, Japanese cuisine and sometimes sake and some other topics along those lines are related. What are your favorite topics to cover on the show? And please tell me it's sake.
Of course. Sake is of course. Yeah, sake of course is interesting. And I know I tell you why, because I'm looking for interesting stories behind each topic. Sake, for example, it can be about the family history or type of koji and how the koji can produce interesting flavors to, you know, why this brewery decided to be organic or something very personal and way beyond a glass of sake. So each time I prepare a show, for a show, it's always like reading a book. There's so many interesting stories about the person. So it's hard to say which one is my favorite, which one is not. I have to say, each time I'm reading a great book, that's how I feel.
Yeah, that's really cool. I like that. Yeah, so it does make it more compelling when you dig behind the scenes a little bit. It's not just the technical side of koji, but about the family history, like you said. That's really wonderful. Now, you've been a consultant and an advisor and author about all things Japanese cuisine for a while. And I know you're personally a fan of Japanese sake. We've met at many sake events here in New York City over the years. How would you say, from your point of view as a culinary expert, how would you say the sake market has changed over the last 10 years in the United States?
So, as you know, the Japanese sake industry has been declining for many reasons, like, you know, hard work, younger people not drinking sake anymore, and all those many reasons. But the overseas market is growing so fast, thanks to hardworking sake brewers who are really aware of the importance of outside market. And also, of course, experts like you guys who really educate people how to drink sake, why sake is so delicious and enjoyable. I learned that in 2020, the biggest sake export market is Hong Kong, China, and the number three is America. It's 20% of the total export by value. So we are drinking more better sake as well over time. And well, that's one thing. The sake market is really more sophisticated in America. And also, I'm always excited to see new American breweries in America, you know, like sake breweries that are really producing high-quality sake. So, for example, I had, you know, Brooklyn Kura and Kato Sake Works in New York, and also the North American Sake Brewery in Virginia. And those, I think there are over two dozens of sake breweries in America. And just like sushi, you know, the California rolls were created in California by, I think, American Japanese entrepreneur, actually, to target wide broader market who could be interested in sushi. And now people don't mind paying a couple hundred dollars per person for authentic edamame style sushi. So I see that what's happening here could be the same path to popularity of sushi. Sushi is now part of American diet. So, yeah, I feel so excited because American sake breweries, they are both creating authentic style of sake as well as something very terroir-driven American style sake.
Mm-hmm. actually a really good point about the evolution of sushi in the American kind of mind frame. I think if you go back to like the mid-90s and you say sushi to somebody and they think it's just this bizarre, exotic thing. Oh my God, cold fish, that's horrifying. Like it was the attitude on it back then was completely different than it is now. And it's been such an interesting thing to see that change relatively quickly, at least in my eyes, even though it's like 25 years, but it's still been like, it's still a complete, 180 as far as how Americans view sushi. But back to the sake topic for a moment, you've had a lot of sake related content on the show. You mentioned having Brooklyn Kura and Kato Sake Works on and North American Sake. What is your personal experience with sake and what kind of sake do you like? What styles do you go for?
So first time, I would say my first memory about sake is that my dad loved sake. So, but I was never interested in drinking sake myself. And then I left Japan and then I started to be more interested in alcoholic beverages. First time I was really interested in alcoholic beverage was wine. And when the first time I had shabui, like, what is that? Then I studied, you know, wine and visited wineries and breweries and those things. So by learning how it's made, who it's making, the whole understanding of what you put in your mouth changes, right? So the same thing happened to my mind when I started working with Japanese local governments and then started visiting sake breweries and spoke to those people. It was fascinating. So I think it's based on my wine knowledge, it's interesting to compare. And I appreciate sake because of my wine knowledge. Because it's like there's some common way to analyze taste, which is not common in Japanese sake community, because you don't analyze as much as Western-style wine analysis. Unfortunately, my dad passed away 2 years ago, but since then, I started being really into sake. I would go back to Japan and always share a bottle of nice sake. And we really enjoyed drinking sake together.
Yeah. So for you, wine was actually the way to get into the world of sake. You studied wine first and then came back around and discovered sake through that?
Yeah, that is correct. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. So what are your... When you're having alone time, no business, nobody around. When you're enjoying sake at home with your friends and family, what are your styles that you gravitate towards?
When it comes to tasting something, I'm very adventurous and curious. So I tend to try something I never tried before. But also so people call me oyaji. Oyaji means old man. I tend to prefer something like dry and savory. So if I have to pick one flavor profile, it tend to be dry and savory.
There's a bar that I've gone to in Tokyo called Ganko Oyaji, which means like, that's... I think it means stubborn old man.
Yeah, stubborn old man.
I think that's a bar for you, Akiko.
I think so.
That is a lovely bar, by the way.
It is.
When we all can go back to Japan again.
Let's meet at Ganko Oyaji.
Okay, let's do it.
All right. And speaking of sake and Oyaji-style sake, we let Akiko choose the sake we're going to drink today. And it is Kenbishi Honjozo. So we're digging our heels into that Oyaji territory a little bit there, I think. Tim, do you want to go a little bit more in depth on this?
Yeah, let me just introduce the sake to our listeners, Akiko, and then we'll pour some out and start tasting. So this is, as John just mentioned, a Honjozo. So Honjozo is that alcohol-added style of sake. This is from Kenbishi Sake Brewery in Hyogo Prefecture, which is one of the main regions for sake. It's got between 16 and 17% alcohol, a very low SMB of 0.5, and then a higher acidity, 1.7. And the rice that they use for this sake is Ayama and Yamada Nishiki, both milled to 70% remaining. So not a very fine milling rate. All right. Mm. So I'm going to pour this into my wine glass. Oh, it's yellow.
A little bit, yeah.
One other thing I want to mention, Akiko, is that this brand introduces themselves as the oldest brand in Japan. Hmm. On the label, John, look on the label. Doesn't it say oldest brand?
It does say oldest brand. And I'm about to answer my own question. I was going to say, well, how old? It says since 1505.
Yes.
So
the logo they use for the Kenbishi brand looks like a shield. It's like a black, solid black mark that looks kind of like a medieval shield shape. And they've been using that logo since the 1500s.
Wow.
Wow.
So that's something amazing. Okay, so I have this poured. And Akiko, I think you brought the sake in. You got the one cup, right? The sake cup?
Yeah, actually, I chose this one because what I heard is this won an award for design award in Japan in 2008. Mm. And the thing is that it's 180 milliliters, which is very small, and it's appealing to younger generations whenever got interested in sake, and it's very fashionable. And you can use it after you empty this, you can use it as a tokuri, which is a, you know, serving vessel. And it's really cute. And I heard that the heat distribution is really functional because of this shape. Mm-hmm. It's like a, you know, bigger shoulder shape in a small bottle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I thought it was very smart.
Yeah. Well, if I started making sake in 15 something and I had to wait until 2018 to win a design award, I might be a little upset. But but better late than never, right?
Of course not. It's like you can do anything. Even now.
All right. Well, John, you have your sample poured?
I do have it poured, slightly chilled. Yep. And then I believe we're also going to do something a little warm, right?
Yeah. So let's try the sample chilled first. I have mine in a wine glass. You can see the color. It's got a nice light straw color. Mm-hmm. Very lovely. Almost looks like a white wine.
Yeah, it's like a Sauvignon Blanc kind of greener
color, right?
Like pale green.
Yeah. Well, let's give it a smell.
Wow. Mm. Wow.
So I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but this smells cheesy.
Cheesy.
It smells like a little bit of a cheese rind or something like that for me.
Definitely.
Mm. Very deep fermentation aroma.
Right.
Yes.
And it's very ricey, like.
Ricey, yeah.
Very much. And there's a lot of it. It is not subtle. It is not in any way. When we're talking about rice and cheese as being some of the things that we smell on this, definitely in your face. Mm.
But interesting, like right after that, there's like a, I don't know, like citrusy or some like a elderberry. Like hint of some refreshing elderberry, like gin. So it's kind of balances
botanicals.
Out. Yeah.
Like a botanical. Yeah.
Yeah. Once you said gin, I was like, and my eyes lit up. I'm like, that's exactly what it is.
Akiko-san, that wine training is coming in handy.
Yeah, right.
It really is.
All right. Let's give it a taste.
Mm. Wow.
Mmm. Lots of umami, very savory, almost like soy sauce.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh my God, my cheek hurts. It's so much.
And we've talked before about like sake's being like the fruit bomb. This is the umami bomb. Mm.
This is the umami bomb. Yes. Mm. Very savory, warming, umami rich. Mm-hmm. Think about soy sauce flavors, miso flavors. This would pair so well with so many things in Japanese cuisine because of that dashi umami flavor.
Do you know how you name that flavor? It's called kokumi. Kokumi is a
kokumi.
Yeah, it's the sixth flavor after umami. So sweet, salty, bitter, sour, umami, and then there's kokumi, which means richness. Like typically, you have very rich dashi. You know, Japanese style stock. It's like a richness and deep beyond umami depth. That's called kokumi. And I think it's going to be the terminology in the culinary world very soon.
Oh my gosh, this is breaking news.
I like this, Tim. We're getting ahead.
There's a new flavor. I did not know that. Yeah. Kokumi.
Kokumi, yeah.
Wow, okay. So this is an example of kokumi.
Indeed.
Kind of like ultra rich umami.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. Love it.
Kokumi bomb. Mm. And Tim, as you implied, this is this would go so well with food. I think this is begging for food. It is so just ready to be drunk alongside something really nice and rich that's going to complement it wonderfully.
Yeah. Akiko, do you have any ideas for food pairings with this sake at this temperature, kind of slightly chilled or room temperature?
This one, I would think roast chicken.
Yeah, that sounds great. I was thinking of oden. So oden is something I discovered in Japan. They sell it in convenience stores. It's on the counter. And when I first saw it, I said, what's that brown food? they soak all kinds of delicious nibbles in like a soy sauce broth, and it turns everything brown, whether it's daikon or eggs. And it infuses these kind of more neutral flavors with a delicious umami, brown color, and kind of a savoriness. Mm. And you eat it almost like a chunky stew, like you put pieces on a plate and there's a little sauce in there too. I think that would go great with this. What do you think?
It sounds like it would work.
Yeah.
Right. I think because oden has different ingredients, and this could be the kind of, you know, binder that connects every single piece of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For me, I just keep thinking like late night izakaya. And like that kind of food, like the kind of food you get at like after last train in Japan style, like late night izakaya, like 1 a.m.
Right.
You're eating stuff that's a little bit greasier, but yeah, still like you know, maybe kushikatsu.
Mm. Yum.
Yeah, that's definitely oyaji moment.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And John, I have to remind our listeners that one of my New Year's resolutions was to drink outside my comfort zone. And I think that because of Akiko's suggestion, we're going there.
Tim, we can't see your comfort zone from here.
I'm trained to love clean and crisp and light sake. And this is the polar opposite, but it's so delicious and so rich. And I'm really enjoying it. So as a bonus, we have prepared this sake at a warmer temperature as well. And this, again, was also Akiko's recommendation to try it chilled and warm. And I have my warm carafe here, so I'm going to pour this as well.
Mine is warmed up as well.
So what do you think of the aroma when it's warm?
The aroma, I'm not sure if it's the vessel that I'm drinking out of, which is a traditional ceramic ochoko. Mm-hmm. But it's much more contained. Like the aroma is much more subtle now.
I agree. It feels a little less pointed and a little less expressive, a little more muted.
Interesting. Because I have this huge double bottom glass with a huge mouth. And it's more floral. And then, and before I used a smaller mouth. Rido wine glass. And then I think because of the temperature, I have a little spiciness in finish. So it's like floral and spicy, and it's this very different experience out of same 100 milliliter small glass amaso jar. But I have to say, mine is, I think, lower temperature. It's like a below nurukan.
Okay. Yeah,
I think yours is more temperature controlled.
Yeah. My sample, I think, is a Jokan temperature around 115 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mine is showing as 112 right now.
Okay.
My little thermometer.
Yeah. So it's a very gentle warming. And I'm still picking up on savoriness and umami in the aroma, but for me, it feels a little like a little more muted and not as in your face. Mm. It feels a little softer around the edges when you warm it up. And now let's give it a taste. Very excited. Mmm. Oh, wow.
Hmm.
Wow.
This is wildly different.
Very, very different. I mean, it's still savory and it's still warm and there's still umami, but it spreads across your palate a lot wider, coats your mouth, and it has a longer finish. Are you experiencing mm-hmm. that as well?
It's almost a numbing, like spiciness on your tongue. Mm. And this one, I would want to have baked fish, like Japanese style, salt, and something very simple.
Oh, yeah. Like in the autumn, they serve the silverfish that's been roasted. Yeah, they have samma every autumn in Japan, and it's like the quintessential autumnal dish.
Yeah.
And I think that would go really well with this.
Right. And the samma has a bitterness. Like a part of samma has a very like red meat bitterness. Mm. So that would be perfect with this kind of spicy, long-lasting experience in your tongue.
Yeah, this really has a longer finish to it. The flavor stays with you longer when it's warmed up.
Right.
Really interesting.
Hmm.
It's so great. The fact that you can serve the same sake at quite a cold temperature, quite a warm temperature, room temperature, it's an amazing superpower that sake has that not many other alcoholic beverages have. And we really can't forget how delicious sake can be when you warm it up. Warm sake's got kind of a bad rap over recent history. And I think it's time to reform the image of warm sake as something super delicious. And this sake really proves it.
And also, you don't have to mill down rice because it's only 30% milled away. So it's amazing how delicate it can be with this in-your-face rice flavor. It can be so delicate.
Too many people are chasing super low milling rates. You know, I'm down to 5%, 4%. I'll see your 4% and give you 3%.
I like to call that stunt samaibuai. Stunt
samaibuai. But no doubt about it. Those sakes are delicious.
Oh, yeah,
This just shows you what you can do when you leave more rice grain in the tank. You get more complex and rich, earthy flavors. There's more fats and proteins that get into the mash and onto our palates. And it really adds dimension to the taste, I think.
Mm. Right. Mm-hmm. The one thing I read on their website is that their milling rate changes depending on the year because it's based on how the rice was grown. So it's the focus is the consistency of the taste of sake, not the number. So I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah. Mm. Well, after 500 years, I think they know what they're doing, I hope.
Well, they finally figured out the design.
Yeah.
So, but it seems that they might have figured out the sake a very long time ago. And personally, I think that it's good for my sake breweries to be focusing on the sake first, and then the design can come later. 500 years.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, this has been so much fun. Wonderful tasting with you, Akiko. Now, we want to make sure that our listeners can find you, find your podcast. So can you let us know the best way for listeners to learn more about your show and about your work?
Sure. So you can find Japan Eats. It's on, as a podcast, it's on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. And also you can go to the Heritage Radio website. That's heritageradionetwork.org. And also if you go to kikokatayama.com, that's my website. There are all the links that you'd like to find.
Wonderful. And we'll be sure to link up all of those in our show notes.
Thank you.
As well as a picture of that bottle, the 180 milliliter bottle of Kenbishi, because it is very striking and very beautiful. Yep. It earned that award.
After 500 years.
Let's start the history now.
Wonderful. Mm. So we'll be sure to put all those links into our show notes. Akiko, thank you so much for joining us. It was an absolute pleasure. I hope you'll stay around for a kanpai at the end.
Of course. Thank you so much. It was an honor. I'm a huge fan of your podcast. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. Wonderful to have you. Well, I want to thank all of our listeners so much for tuning in. We really do hope that you're enjoying our show. Now, if you'd like to show your support for Sake Revolution, one way you can really help us out would be to take a couple of minutes and leave us a quick written review on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way for us to get the word out about our show.
And when you're done writing your review in Apple Podcasts, please go and tell a friend and then subscribe. And then tell your friend to subscribe too. This way, every week, whenever we put out a new episode, it will show up on your device of choice and you will not miss a single episode.
And as always, to learn more about any of the topics, any of the people, or any of the sake we talked about in today's episode, be sure to visit our website, sakerevolution.com, for all the detailed show notes.
And we know that you at home have sake questions that you need answered, and we want to hear them. Please reach out to us. The email address is feedback@sakerevolution.com. So until next time, please raise a glass and remember to keep drinking sake and
kanpai!
Yay!
Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.